Hi, I'm Dave Manor. Can everybody hear me?
Cool.
Too loud? Not loud enough? Should stop touching that. You are in the deep knowledge track. Trust no one, not even yourself, or the weak link might be your build tools. First of all, let me start off a little bit. I'm Dave Manor. I'm from the ISS X-Force Research and Development Group. I have to preface by saying that although this speech appears to have very malicious implications, one of the things that we do in the X-Force is identify new security problems before they actually become security problems. So that's actually one of the reasons this came about, is to shed light on a subject that hasn't had much press or discussion. So without further ado, let's start off. So one of the reasons why you might want to think about something like this is simple security holes are becoming a thing of the past. They're getting harder and harder to find. There's more protection being built into products. Developers in general are getting better. It's getting harder and harder to find simple problems that we all remember and love so much, like store copying gets simple stack-based overflows. On the flip side, the increase in heap overflows is taking up some of the slack, but heap overflows generally make reliability across platforms and service packs somewhat hard. And as I said before, there's a lot more things. Like, for instance, stack protection is being shipped with a lot more Linux distributions now. Microsoft's embracing it, and it's harder and harder to compromise things in traditional way. So now that we've talked about the tools, developers themselves are becoming better, more educated. They're constantly bombarded with information about what makes bad code, how to exploit it. A lot of information is becoming available that hasn't been before to make developers better. So in addition to just not only the built-in protection mechanisms, the developers themselves are making code safer. So this isn't looking so good for people who want to compromise machines. In addition to that, new security technologies are making it harder, even with zero-day exploits, to reliably compromise machines. IDS, IPS, firewall, gateway, antivirus technologies, they're all being deployed in record numbers now. And it really makes like a single-shot exploit, like if you had, for instance, a zero-day sendmail exploit, it's harder today to compromise a machine with it than it would be, like, for instance, 4 years ago. The stateful inspection and deep threat analysis technologies are becoming commonplace. That means that there's just better protection at borders of a lot of places. And remote attacks are becoming less likely to succeed, even with 0 days. Things like HTTP proxies make connect back for shellcode hard. And believe me, there's nothing worse than finding a machine compromised, like during a penetration test or something, and launching an exploit. It works, but you can't get connect back shell because the outgoing proxy is not allowing it or something like that. NAT is also another problem for things like this, reverse NATs and whatnot. Attackers have to start looking at different places, penetration testers and whatnot, to start looking at different places, overlooked places in security architectures of companies. The last couple of years, a lot of people have been cutting costs, consolidating things. A lot of people are sharing resources that weren't being shared before. And open source projects are gaining a lot more popularity in marketplace because of the low implementation cost and the relatively quick updates and whatnot to security problems. So this actually presents a pretty interesting attack avenue for somebody, and that is attacking the compiler or trojaning the compiler so that as software is being built, something malicious is done to it or backdoors is being done to it. There's a couple questions that when I proposed this question to people, I always got. The first one was always, can attackers really backdoor the code as it's being built? There's no reason they can't. It's a very simple thing, actually. Well, my answer, of course, is yes, or this would be a boring speech. You guys look bored already. Will it be noticed?
Well, it depends. You know, remember, was anybody here at the keynote this morning and the guy kept making that strange noise? So when you breathe straight down on the mic with your nose, it makes that flapping noise. I just noticed that. That's kind of annoying.
Will it be noticed? Well, it depends on the payload. What the attacker was hoping to accomplish with this, more than likely, you're not going to, unless you're doing deep inspection of your binary after you build it. And I don't know anybody that's currently doing that. You probably won't find this. It also depends on what kind of file format you're attacking. I mean, if you add an extra 180 lines to a PE binary, more likely somebody's not going to notice that when it gets built. And subtle OS changes, like somebody decides that an offset's suddenly going to change in a compiler or whatnot, you might break it. So this has a couple of problems with the heap overflow reliability issues, but it's still a pretty interesting avenue. Is it easy? The short answer to that is no. The long answer to that is no. It's a very complex attack. It requires deep knowledge of the compiler you're using, of the file format target, and of the operating system itself. Originally, the speech was designed to encompass in-depth analysis of the ELF and PE binaries, as well as the ABIs, which are application binary interfaces, for the target operating systems. But when I did the dry run of that speech, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 hours. So I didn't think Jeff would like that, so I had to cut it down a little bit. And those were the PE and the ELF in-depth stuff and the ABI stuff had to go. But in order to even think about undertaking something like this, you really need to have a deep understanding of your target. Yeah, and in addition to that, before you could hope to use this in a penetration test or similar avenues, there's a couple things you need. First of all, access to the build machine. Now, a lot of people, when originally posed this idea, respond with, who's going to know, you know, who wouldn't notice you recompiling somebody's compiler on their build machines? Often, this requires just replacing a single library or so, a single file. And a lot of times, in a lot of default, like, host-based installations, nobody really covers that much. They worry more about executables and things like that. They kind of leave the libraries alone for some reason. As I said, you need expert knowledge of compiler and output file format and expert creation of the payload. This isn't quite just like writing a reverse shell for shellcode or whatnot. You have to be able to, if you want to remain undetectable, you have to have a goal in mind. You have to be able to execute the goal at the appropriate time and then allow the program to continue operation without breaking the flow, because the biggest way a person can detect this is that your program sigsecvs with a strange error message in a part of code that doesn't even really seem to exist to the developer. And as I said, the payload, I'm using payloaders in the code that's being added at build time. It can range from anything to shell access to the ability to remotely track these binaries wherever they go. What can the results of an attack like this yield? Well, it really depends on your imagination and your technical competency. But if you have access to the compiler, you can pretty much make the source code do whatever you want when it builds. And a couple of examples of this are email encryption programs. For instance, if somebody were to Trojan build a PGP, they can actually automatically add a backdoor key or something like that, or encrypt the contents of the message with a key other than the one intended, or save a copy of the message. SSL, a lot of this deals with encryption because that's actually one of the more scary avenues, because it's encrypted, people feel they're safe from it, and an attack methodology like this kind of would break that. Not because it's weakening the encryption itself, but other ways. SSL, you can weaken or change the server keys, or you can allow a local host to sniff the SSL communications. Banking applications, everybody loves those. We keep our money safe. They can also create secret storage of personal information or transmit information about you to a third-party source. Or last but not least, the kernel. And if you are able to Trojan a compiler that's building a kernel for an operating system, the sky's the limit. You can do whatever you pretty much want in the binary. How portable is it? Well, it's not really. You know, a lot of people are going to laugh at this, the Win32 versus Linux thing, but I get this a lot, especially with tools that do cross-compilation. A question often asked is, can you build a PE binary with the same payload as the ELF binary? The short answer is yes, but you need to put a lot more work into it. The long answer is I wouldn't really attempt that. And like I said, it depends on the actual payload, and I really wouldn't want to encourage that. Across file formats, PE versus ELF versus COF, and I know somebody might point out that PE is an evolution of COF and whatnot, but it there's still some operating systems I've come across that just use the old COF format, which is why it's on here. They're all very, well, PE versus ELF are very different. So more than likely, once again, without constructing your compiler, basically writing two completely different backdoors for the compiler, you're not going to have really much use for this. And it depends on where the payload is. And we're going to talk about places to put your payload and things to do with it a little later. But this is a lot like the Win32 versus Linux versus Unix debate. It might be possible, but I don't really see why you'd want to do it. And across architectures, RISC versus CISC. This is a little more different. This depends on how the payload is encoded. The example that was originally brought up was Windows NT used to run on, Alpha, and also on x86. So if you chosen a compiler to build a program that runs, well on x86, will it still work on an Alpha platform? The answer is no, because first of all, they're compiled for different platforms. This is similar to like downloading RPMs for different architectures, for like Red Hat or something, and trying to make them work. They're compiled for different architectures. There's a lot of differences in here, like the way the stack rows, word size, things like that, and that would make it working across platforms not really that possible. So the first thing we're going to look at, the first thing we're going to start off with is GCC. Anybody here use GCC to develop code, software? Nobody? You heard of GCC? Awesome. GCC is a pretty ubiquitous in our industry because it pretty much comes with every distribution of Linux or any open source operating system. Where does it come from? Who writes it? It comes from the GNU Foundation. The GNU Foundation. It was originally released May 23rd, 1987. And the current version, as of this writing, is 3.4.0. It's written by the Free Software Foundation. What is it? It's more of a suite than a single tool. I used to work for a major university before I worked for ISS, so I got to deal with a lot of computer science students and whatnot. And a lot of them had the idea that GCC or G++ was a single tool, and that it had a specific purpose and it only did one thing. And then they were always amazed to find out that, depending on the front end or the back end of the compiler, it pretty much compile any language, and I'll put it in pretty much any file format. If you're more interested in like the backends, the link lists all the backends that are currently supported. That's actually something I completely ran over. Is anybody here familiar with compiler technology, internals, whatnot? All right. Well, a compiler is generally separated into two pieces. The front end and the back end, and I'm going to talk about those a lot, so I guess I should go over it now. The front end, for those who don't know, is generally language dependent. For instance, you'd have for GCC, you have a C front end, you have a C++ front end, Java, Objective-C, whatever. You have these front ends, and they're language specific. And what they do is turn the language, turn the source file into a meta language that can be interpreted then by the back end. The back end then is more hardware dependent. Backends that support i386 or ARM or whatnot. So that's a flow from the front to the back. Generally, most of these attacks will be dependent on the front end. The back end wouldn't really, depending on how it's implemented, you can get to some pretty hairy things. I use GCC. Can I be affected by this? The answer is yes. What does GCC actually do to the code? We're going to go up to phases of compiling. Does anybody have GCC here? I mean, you can follow along pretty simply. Just write a quick hello program and, printf, whatever. And then you can run through the phases of compilation. The first thing that happens when you invoke GCC, for instance, GCC hello.c, is the driver gets invoked. And the driver is actually the the brains of the suite. It's going to invoke the proper tool at the proper time, and basically take you from creating from your source file to an actual binary file. So your preprocessor, and if you want to see your preprocessor outputs, you can just run GCC space dash capital E in your source file and see what it looks like after the preprocessor. You can, what that does is that goes through and find all your pound includes, things like that, put those into your source file, things like that. Then there's the actual compiler, and if you want to create an object file, which is the output of the compiler, you can just do gcc-c. And what this is actually the compiled code before the assembler and the linker. So you can run gcc-c and see what it looks like. It's a binary format, so you're going to need some tools to take a look at it. We're going to talk about those tools later. And then GCC, I list optimizer as a different step, but the optimizer is a part of the actual C compiler. So it was broken out more later applications. Then there's the assembler in GCC dash capital S, which show you the output of the assembler format. And this is you're close to the machine code at this point. Your assembly right now, and the only stage you're really waiting for is linking and loading. And the linker and loader are next. Points where GCC modifies the original code are, of course, the preprocessor, the compiler or optimizer, and the linker. And I was going to go over optimizations a little bit, but the general rule of thumb here is optimizations generally will break this. Please try to avoid those in the compilation process. How can an attacker use this to their advantage? Best places to attack. If you've got a Linux machine with you right now, go and take a look in user lib. And you'll see a couple files called CRT0, CRTI, things like that. This is a funny question, and a lot of people don't know this. Where does your code actually start executing when you write a program? A lot of people, the first thing they say is main. And that's not actually true. When you load a binary into memory and begin getting ready to actually call your code, there's a lot of things that are done for you that you don't realize. Memory structures are set up, your heap and stacks are initialized, you parse your command line options and get it ready. A lot of people, it's funny, didn't know where argc and argv come from. They thought it was something magical. But it's all set up for you ahead of time. And most of this is done in the underscore start function. You can take a look at it from a glib, you actually need the source for glibc to take a look at this. The start.s, which is the assembly version of it. It's going to set up your initial environment variables, command line arguments, and then it calls main. Now, if you want a nice, soft, easy target, this is the best place to do it. Right after everything's set up and right before main gets called, when you're debugging the application, generally, if you're going to debug, you'll set a breakpoint for main initially. Well, like I said, a lot of people aren't realizing there's actually code executing before that. So a lot of people will initially miss that. It's a pretty soft place. You can put assembly or pretty much whatever you want. Well, it's got to be assembly actually at this point. But you can put whatever you want in there to do various things. Scan command line options, check for certain information or if a token is present or whatnot. That's probably one of the easiest and safest places to actually start this at. The analysis of the front end and back end for attack points. The things to consider are breaking the program. As I mentioned earlier, the biggest thing you want to keep in mind is you don't want to break the program. You want the program to be able to continue its normal operations, or the element of surprise you've gained by doing this completely lost. Also, compatibility. You don't want to build a binary. This is going to be then taken to another machine and ran, which will make your payload break. Once again, that's going to point out the obvious that you've actually been in there. At this point, I had planned on showing you the payload in C or in XA6ASM and shell code. However, I can't get wireless internet access up here, so visualize it. It's pretty cool. There's some brackets, a couple pointers. It's awesome. And this is where I would actually do the examples of what you can do with GCC. Once again, this is going to require some imagination because I can actually show you right now. So the first
the first example was I was going to add a stub to start to jump to an object file that gets linked in automatically. That actually adds socket code to your application that would generate a single UDP datagram and send it to a predetermined IP address every time the program is ran. And it's kind of funny when you have a hello world program and it's opening up sockets. A lot of people get kind of weird. The thing that's kind of odd. The other example was, I got these confused. The other example was an underscore start function that was going to parse through command line options after they're set up and look for a specific set of flags. And when those flags were found, you would exec a shell with the UID and GID of the person that owns the binary. As you can imagine, that wouldn't be too good if you're in charge of protecting this stuff. Any questions, comments, suggestions? Dan Kaminsky's bored. My compiler is not open source. I must be safe, right? And this is the second or third question I always get when I talk about this. Well, you can do this with GCC because it's open source, thus proving open source is bad. I use Visual Studio. I can't be attacked, right? The answer to that is no. No, you can be attacked. I'm actually, for this demo, we were looking at Visual Studio 6 for a couple reasons. I didn't want to go over .NET stuff because that in itself would be a whole other talk. Things you could do with .NET. And Visual Studio 6 is pretty simple. It's written by Microsoft. Visual Studio is an integrated development environment, as a lot of people know. So it's not just a compiler, an assembler, and a linker. It's an IDE as well. It's primarily used for Windows development. You don't really build a lot of Linux code with Visual Studio. Although you could. I don't know why you'd want to. Weak links. CRT 0. You're going to see the CRT stuff a lot. CRT stands for C runtime. So these are C runtime libraries. And if you actually look for CRT0.c on a machine with Visual Studio installed, you'll find these comments. This is the actual start routine for the apps. It calls user's main routine, main, or wmain after performing C runtime library initializations. So this is pretty much equivalent to what we were looking at before with GCC and underscore start. It's in C, it doesn't require that much assembly to craft a payload. But one of the problems is actually getting it in the library. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. There's main CRT startup. If anybody has IDA, you can grab a copy of that. Actually, when you open up most binaries, they're built with Visual Studio or whatnot. You'll see that main CRT startup is what actually does the underscore start stuff for PE. It's going to go through and set up your environment variables, your command line options, and it's going to call main. Interesting things in it. This is pretty much the order it goes. It declares an integer called, I'm calling it retval. Then it does an initialization for the heap, parse command line, then init your global variables, then init exception handling. Then you get retval equal main, which is what actually calls the user written code. So like I said, when a lot of people start reverse engineering, they're somewhat surprised that their code doesn't start at main. You can actually build a binary in Visual Studio that doesn't use all the CRT default libraries, and this is pretty much how you do it. But when you build it, you're going to get a lot of unresolved externals because it's looking for stuff that's not linked in there. And once again, this is where I would show payload examples in C++, ASM, and how to add code before main and when main back to the visualization. It's cool. All right. Now we're pretty much at a portion. We've talked about two well-known compilers. A lot of people use one or the other. We're going to talk about LCC for a little bit. LCC is a free open source compiler. It's covered in the book, Building a Retargetable C Compiler. I recommend this book to anybody that wants to know more about compiler technology or operations. And I once overheard at a party, it's the new Dragon book. Don't ask what kind of party I was at where we were talking about compilers, but it was a pretty cool party. It's popular in colleges for learning compiler internals because a lot of people are somewhat intimidated by the Dragon book. It's a great book.
LCC is a compiler that they build throughout the book. They actually build this compiler and as the chapters progress. So not only will you get to use LCC, you have a pretty good understanding for it. How does it differ from Visual Studio or GCC? It's less popular. I don't really think I've ran into too many other people that know it that well or anything. It's not used in businesses or environments like that much. And it also doesn't go over, it doesn't include a lot of optimizations. It's pretty much your meat and potatoes of compilers. So the reason I'm including this is this is a great compiler to take a look at to use these concepts, to apply these concepts. So binary analysis, best way to learn about something is to use it. So here's where I would show you the example of how I compile my amazingly cool I Love Black Hat Hello World program with LCC. It would produce a binary called Black Hat. Then we're going to use a tool called NM. Anybody familiar with it? I prefer to use the -p option. NM-p will show everything in the order it's encountered, rather than sort it. So these are basically your functions, static strings, the functions, sections and things like that. In the binary I compiled with LCC. So as you go through it, you can see that there's a lot of stuff in here that most people didn't write, like underscore init, underscore start, the BSS start, things like that. And then you see down at a very low memory address, main. So you have a whole lot of room to work with this compiler. Here we do obj dump -d. That actually produces a lot of output because what it's going to do is run through and do a disassembly on a binary section by section. So the image is like huge, but try it, take a look at it, it's pretty fun, and it shows you what can be done. So determine how to interpret your findings, determine what the compiler does to the code. So you can go through the steps, as I showed earlier with GCC, with LCC, and you can stop after pre-processing, after compilation phase, after the assembly phase, and of course after linking. And you can use various tools like NM, OBJ dump, and things like that to view what has been done to your code as it goes through each step. And that's very important for understanding what comes next. You want to look for stuff that's generated by the compiler or stuff that you didn't write, basically. You're looking for things that you can add to without breaking program functionality or anything like that. And finding out where the compiler stores its code. A lot of what a compiler does, it links in libraries and whatnot. So although the you might actually not be attacking the compiler itself, but rather libraries that links in, things like that. Thankfully, there are only basic attacks. Aside from simple code ejection, what else can be done? So we're going to talk about briefly about advanced attack methods, things like adding code to GitOp. This would be similar to adding your own command line option, --0wn or something to spawn a shell. My favorite one here, and a lot of people like this one, is replacing safe functions with unsafe functions. One of the demos I was supposed to run for you, I do a stir copy from the command line into a buffer, and I use stir and copy, and I only copy the amount the buffer can hold. My patch actually will go through and replace stir and copy with stir copy and kick out the third arguments because it just needs two. This opens up a whole new area for things. As we previously mentioned earlier, these unsafe functions aren't being seen as much. However, with an attack methodology like this, you can add them back in or get rid of balance checking altogether. One of the things that's great is doing dependent attacks. A lot of people will define debug or whatnot while it's in testing and then remove it for actual production and whatnot. So one of the things you might want to think about is searching command line or options, see if debug is defined. Other examples that work with socket apps will only be included into binaries that are being built with the socket code. I mean, you don't want to add a socket trojan to something that doesn't have it, a socket app. Or attack only if it's a set UID app. And you don't want to you don't want to do this to every binary that comes along. You only want to do it to things that I guess would give you a strategic advantage. And you know, calc.exe isn't going to do it for you. So you might want to wait until it's something with elevated privileges. And this is where I would do the by-body balance checking. Just visualize it. It's such a cool thing. Actually, yes, I can. In the pre-processing phase, what this patch does is it looks for a list of safe functions and just simply replaces them with unsafe functions. Like the biggest ones it looks for are stir copy, well, stir and copy. Now, since the function prototype changes, the patch is smart enough to know what options it needs in the unsafe function and take from the safe one. That is a funny question. Thankfully, they're only basic attacks. Tools the compilers work with and how they can turn against you. So more than just a compiler, you've got the linker, the assembler, the libtool, AR, things for generating archives, things like that. These are all targets for this type of attack. Nothing's really that hard to actually do this sort of behavior. Other than owning things, is this useful? Yes, actually, as I mentioned before, you might actually want to do things like, a good example of this is honeypot technology. Applying this to a honeypot would be something similar to you Trojan the compiler on a Linux machine that you set up as a honeypot. You wait for somebody to compromise it, either SCP or SCP their binary or source code in and build it. Then you can add like a unique hash to the header or whatnot. For tracking across where it goes. In addition to that, you can actually also Trojan several functions like mmap. So when the function gets mapped into memory to execute, it can make a change to the actual binary on disk. So it doesn't really have to be a compiler to do this. The great example of this is the UDP packet I was talking about earlier that sends a UDP packet back to an arbitrary address. So you can track where this code goes across network and whatnot that was built on your machine. That's pretty cool. How do I detect this? Well, this is kind of a funny thing. It was easier to create the problem than the solution. So static backtraces is a good way to detect this. Basically looking at what functions are called and from where, what address spaces, things like that. Because generally building a binary up until main or whatnot, everything pretty much should be standard. So if you're calling strange functions from strange places, you can pretty bet something's strange going on there. I wrote a tool for this actually called Ice Blast. It does just that. Basically what it will do is it will detect what glibc and compiler version you have. And from the beginning of execution up until the call of main, it will profile what's done, and it knows what should be done, and it can tell you when something strange is happening, like a jump to a weird place in memory or a call that isn't anywhere else. Other things are signatures for compiler operations. IDA does this a lot with their flirt signatures, and this is pretty much similar to what we were talking about before. Optimization, standard functions, step-by-step verification of code at runtime. It allows a person at that was a pretty fast speech actually. This speech was inspired originally by Ken Thompson's piece for the ACM, Reflections on Trusting Trust, and that's a URL where you can read it. Pretty much anything else, and that flew by. Does anybody have any questions? Dan?
Yeah. Are there any preprocessor
lines
that you can set for
GCC
or Visual C++ that
return
value that
ties to
every machine that
would live? Not that I'm aware of. That would be a great thing to research.
It means that every time you compile the application, in the compilation process, things get inserted.
Right, that wouldn't be that difficult to do. This would be similar to the Lexer, the Lexer modification to replace stir and copy with stir copy and whatnot. So it wouldn't actually be that hard to accomplish. It might be something to look forward to for the future. Any other questions? Mr. Maida? No, actually, I've had some discussion with Lance Spitzner of the HoneyNet project about incorporating some of this technology, but at this time, it's currently not. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was if this type of technology is currently being used in honeypots to fingerprint binaries built and transferred. The answer is no. No, it's not. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, since I've been working with this, am I focusing on system libraries for specific applications, or if this is a methodology that works across generic applications? For instance, the modifications to underscore start for GCC would work pretty much across the platform, whether it's a GTK GUI application or a CLI-based tool, because that code is actually called before main. So basically any up binary at this point will work for this. Wait, I saw a hand somewhere. No? Maybe I'm hallucinating. Neil again? Yeah, that was actually the part I ran over, the step-by-step verification of code at runtime. Unless I'm mistaken, Halvar Flake is doing some research with that, and step-by-step verification, well, binary diffing and whatnot. That would be a useful tool for combating an application attack at this layer. The descriptions that we spoke about target primarily the front end. Modifying the loader for the actual operating system might be a little require more than a 75-minute discussion. In the back. I'm sorry. Say again. I'm of two minds on that subject. The initial thought is yes, it'd be those type of environments. Well, his question was, will this type of attack be harder to realize in a managed code environment like .NET or Java? The initial gut reaction I had on that was yes, it's a lot harder to realize. But actually, after discovery, evaluating these technologies, I think it's pretty much just as simple to maliciously divert whichever environment you're referring to do whatever you want, because this happens at a level where no one's really looking for it. So, wait, you don't mean build time, you mean execution time. Oh yeah, execution time would be a whole different story. Like for instance, a Java security manager would stop a lot of this from happening, as well as the .NET CLR stuff would pretty much preclude a lot of the strange things from happening, like socket code in the Hello World app, because it shouldn't be connected to the network. I'm sorry, I thought you meant during the build and not during execution. Any other questions?
Cool. Well, I'm sorry the speech went so quickly, but without my my really cool demos, it was kind of a short. Ow. Kind of a short speech. Well, I guess we're done. Yes.